And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is things that end, some of them badly. My first guest is a journalist and author of eight books who focuses on the story of her own life in her latest book titled My Lie, A True Story of False Memory. We discuss false memory syndrome. My next guest is an author and educator who's made it part of his life's work to gain recognition for the forgotten African-American historical figures. We're going to talk to him about his latest book, Blood and Brotherhood, and some of those forgotten figures. As always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Eugene Stovall was born in Oakland, California. He attended St. Mary's College, but then he left that to serve in the Air Force as a radio repairman. He studied the Swedish Ombudsman at the University of Lund in Sweden. He received an undergraduate degree from the Political Science Department of the University of California at Berkeley and graduated magna cum laude. He received a master's degree from the University of California, Davis, based largely on the Swedish research that he had done in Sweden, and he was also a member of Pi Sigma Alpha Honor Society there. He received a PhD in political theory from the Political Science Department at the University of California at Berkeley, and he has taught at USF, St. Mary's College, San Francisco State University, as well as Merritt College and the University of Phoenix. Welcome to the show, Gene. How are you today?
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you on, because you've got a great story, or I should say stories, to tell. It's amazing to me. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, because you have an interesting story, too. How did you go from once studying for the Catholic priesthood to becoming an ardent preserver of forgotten African-American historical figures? That's a strange transition, isn't it?
Well, it's life. You know, you go through various kinds of transitions, and you bring some of what you had in the prior life with you. I happen to be very interested in various black activities. When I was in the service, I joined the service in 1959 during the last stages of segregation, and had been stationed in Biloxi, Mississippi, so I don't need to tell you what those experiences were like.
Right.
And then when I got out of the service and went to UC Berkeley, I was very active in the Black Student Union. So a lot of my political activism carried on into my intellectual curiosity.
I see. All right. So it's just, to me, a very interesting transition. But you have sort of become one of the country's foremost authorities in this field. The people that you hope to keep their memories alive really laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement in the late 1950s and the 1960s. So tell us about some of the more interesting characters. First of all, let's start with Irene Morgan. She was a predecessor to Rosa Parks, wasn't she?
Absolutely. Irene Morgan is probably the most important black woman in the history of civil rights in the United States.
And yet nobody knows about
her. No one knows who she was. Irene Morgan was 27 years old and supported herself and the family by cleaning houses and washing clothes and caring for children of local whites in her town of Gloucester, Virginia. It was 1944 when Irene boarded a Greyhound bus bound for Baltimore, Maryland, where she had a doctor's appointment to have an examination for a recent miscarriage. A half hour out of Gloucester, however, the Greyhound bus driver, although the bus was completely filled, stopped for two white couple on the road. Then he ordered Irene Morgan and another black woman that was sitting next to her to give up their seats, even though they were fully in the colored section and were within the legal limits for segregation in Virginia. When Irene Morgan refused to give up her seat, the bus driver stopped at this little town named Saluda, stopped at the jail, left the bus, and when he returned, he brought back two sheriff's deputies. The sheriff's deputies tried to arrest Irene Morgan. She refused to leave the bus. They beat her with her nightsticks, dragged her off, and threw her in jail.
Amazing. Now, what happened after that? Was she tried, convicted?
That was that Morgan was found guilty in Virginia of violating Virginia's segregation laws, as well as you might imagine, resisting arrest.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Her case was argued all the way up to the Supreme Court by two NAACP attorneys. One was William Hastie, who later became the dean of the Howard Law School. The other was Thurgood Marshall, who, as you know, became the first black member of the Supreme Court.
That's right. Amazing story.
Yeah.
Now what happened to her?
In a 61 decision handed down on June 3rd, 1946, the Supreme Court struck down Virginia's segregation laws on public interstate carriers, therefore ending segregation on interstate carriers all over the United States.
Ah, that's a great story, Irene Morgan, and yet she's forgotten the history. Why do you think that is, Gene? I mean, this is an incredible story, and obviously groundbreaking, precedent-breaking in the 1940s, and yet nobody today knows her, except, of course, you.
Yeah, well, there's others who know her, but she's not known generally. She's not known generally by blacks, and she's certainly not known generally by whites.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think many black scholars and intellectuals who I've discussed this with have come to the conclusion that Irene Morgan was not the kind of person that the NAACP wanted to have as their poster child for civil rights.
Okay. And
therefore, they waited until they could find someone who was more suitable. Now, what is interesting about this is that Martin Luther King got his reputation and became a national figure because of the Montgomery bus boycott, mm-hmm. which Rosa Parks, the story of not getting off the bus. If you look at his book, Stride Towards Freedom, that was published in 1957, in the middle of the books, like so many of them do, they had all of these pictures. One of the pictures in that book has a white policeman with clearly with lieutenant bars on his shirt with studio cameras hitting his hair just right, booking Rosa Parks. And I've always pointed out that picture to me, and it's also in her book that she wrote.
Mm.
And I pointed out that picture as a way of trying to understand what was actually going on there.
And what do you conclude from that?
Well, I don't know why the Montgomery Police Department had a lieutenant posing to booking Rosa Parks in 1956, other than there had to be some collusion between the police department and the demonstrators. That's the only thing I could come up with.
Wow. We're talking to Eugene Stovall, everybody. We're talking about African-American heroes that should be remembered but aren't, and some fascinating stories there. Let me change gears on you, Gene, just a little bit. Let me ask you about Carlotta Bass.
Yes.
1952, she's the first African-American woman to run for national office, long before Barbara Jordan, long before Maxine Waters. Tell us her story.
Well, Charlotta Bass had been the publisher and managing editor of the California Eagle, which was the first black newspaper south, west of the Mississippi. She had been very active in racial affairs. She was not only a member and president of the local chapter of the NAACP, she was also a member and president of the local chapter of Marcus Garvey's UNIA, which is sort of an anomaly, and it's very ironic since Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois were very, very hated enemies.
Interesting.
Charlotta Bass took the best of both here in Los Angeles. When the movie The Klansman came out, Charlotta Bass was stood alone in protesting. Neither the NAACP nor would UNIA take a stand against the movie The Klansman, which was later renamed Birth of the Nation.
Right.
She protested so loudly that the Klan was able to get Negroes in Los Angeles who were advertising her newspaper to withdraw her ads. And she was put into some dire straits. But some friendly white folks who were working in the Los Angeles City Hall gave her a list of all the blacks that were being subsidized by the Klan. Charlotta Bass published the list. Then those people that were on that list sued Charlotta Bass, her husband, and the California Eagle as the newspaper. And even though she won the suit that kind of drug out for a while, it absolutely drained her economically. And her husband actually died shortly afterwards.
Oh, that's a shame. Wow, what a courageous stand.
It just destroyed them. Then the Klan came to the office and paraded in front of the office. Charlotta Bass held an unloaded weapon, a revolver in her hand, and they went off. She then, of course, continued her activities at a lesser level. She was no longer the economic and political force that she had been before. But as you mentioned, she was on the 1952 Progressive Party ticket as a vice presidential candidate. And then she died later in 1966.
Wow, another fascinating story. We're talking to Eugene Stovall, everybody. We're talking about African-Americans who should be remembered but aren't. And let's go on down this fascinating trail of forgotten history. And I want to say your research really has led you to question how African-American history is being taught in our schools today. Let's talk about one of your more interesting findings, and this happened around the First World War. You contend that the U.S. Army believed that black World War I veterans would actually attempt to start a race war in the United States in the 1920s. So first of all, talk to us about the role that African Americans played in World War I, and then how did the Army come to this conclusion?
Well, in World War I, 200,000 blacks were enlisted in the Army and actually joined and were sent overseas. The great majority of these blacks were actually assigned to grave activities. So they were responsible for actually going to the battlefields, finding the bodies of the American dead, and burying them. There were some few others who were engaged in support units like the truck drivers and cooks, etc., and they saw some limited action. And then, of course, there was the famous regiment called the 369th Regiment. It was called the Fighting 69th. Interesting enough, it was the most decorated fighting regiment in the American of the American forces. And the French actually gave them the regiment a decoration. And believe it or not, there was a movie made about the Fighting 69th. Except in the movie that was made about the Fighting 69th, James Cagney and Pat O'Brien and all these...
Those famous African-American actors.
Were the ones that were depicted as opposed to the African-Americans.
Isn't that interesting? Now, wasn't it true that some African-Americans actually went to France prior to America's entry into the war for a couple of reasons? They wanted to get some action in the war, but more importantly, France was way more tolerant of African-American people at that time, and they found more acceptance there and ended up fighting for the French before America joined.
There were a few that did fight for the French before the Americans, before America entered the war. I'm not as familiar with that part of the history as I am with other parts, but the French Foreign Legion had always accepted non-French nationals, and that, I think, was the basis of having not just African Americans from the United States, but also Africans actually enlisted in the Foreign Legion and that legion saw action in France during the First World War.
All right, so help connect the dots. So here we have African Americans serving in World War One. Some of them very decorated, the 369th Regiment. But how did the American Army, the U.S. Army, come to the conclusion that these blacks were going to come back to the United States and start a race riot?
Well, there is a lot of written documents about the Army's concern about using blacks even during the conflict. And there was, at the very high level, a very important mission that was given to Army intelligence to find out what these blacks were doing, the so-called New Negro. And one of the organizations that they were investigating was Marcus Garvey's United Negro Improvement Association. But another group, which was a much more militant group, which was called the African American Blood Brotherhood. That was an organization that had some more radical notions, and this was what caused the Army intelligence to a great amount of concern. What happened was that another black that we don't think of, name was Warren Harding. He happened to be the first black president of the United States. This person, on May 31st, 1921, at 12 o'clock midnight, signed an executive order turning over to the Interior Department the authority to operate, lease, sell, exchange, and do whatever he wanted with the oil located in the reserve at Elk Hills, California, and Teapot Dome in Wyoming. As soon as Harding signed over this authority to the Interior Department, the head of the Interior Department, the Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, immediately signed over his authority to an oil cartel out of Canada headed by Standard Oil. And also a member of the cartel was Sinclair Oil, which later became Mobil Oil. At the same time that this oil was turned over to the private hands, this theft was covered up by an attack on the Negro residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
by thousands of whites who had been called from all over Oklahoma and from all over Tulsa. The attack was led by two airplanes owned by Sinclair Oil, later become Mobil Oil, who dropped bombs or dynamite and used machine guns to machine gun the residents. The Oklahoma National Guard was also involved, and one of the black heroes of this event was called Peg Leg Taylor. He was a former a veteran of the First World War. He led a group of 20 to 30 blacks in resistance. The city, the neighborhood was attacked at 6 o'clock in the morning. They held out until 12. It took the Oklahoma National Guard to roll up with 50 caliber machine guns and high-powered rifles before they destroyed these 30 people.
And, Gene, that's known as the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot. Over 300 African-Americans were killed in that. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating stuff. We've been talking to Eugene Stovall, African-Americans who should be remembered but aren't. Gene, if people want to learn more about you, hear more of these fascinating stories, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
They can go to my website. It's EugeneStovall.com. It's EugeneStovall.com.
EugeneStovall.com. Gene, it has been a real pleasure and some really interesting historical facts that most of us don't know. Thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.